Welcome back to the podcast. On today's episode, I'm honoured to say we have Davinder, Spot, aka known as Spot the Dave. Davinder, welcome to the episode. Thank you very much for joining me. I'll let you introduce yourself because I know you're doing a lot of different things at the minute. You're attending a lot of different events, so thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So as you know, we always go back to the very beginning on these podcasts. So tell me what it was like for you growing up as a kid.
So I'm British Punjabi, fourth generation immigrant from my dad's side. So my great grandparents moved to England in the 1930s. My grandparents on my dad's side still live here in the UK. And my dad was born and brought up here. So mom's from India. So still have those like deep roots to culture, the culture and being Punjabi. But yeah, grew up in West London in a traditional Punjabi Indian family with my grandparents living in the family home and my brother.
How was it like? Well, what was it like growing up in that environment? Was it tough?
Now when I look back, I think I had the most brilliant and amazing childhood with two mums and two dads and my cousins living on the road and having sleepovers and, you know, my cousins being my best friends and just hanging out with them all the time. I went to, a local school, from primary school to secondary school, and some of my friends I still keep in touch with and are my best friends even now, like 20 years later.
And then what about after school? What was it like for you then?
Yeah, so after school I went to university. So I did the traditional education route. I was one of those like geeks at school. So I was part of the gifted and talented program, which means nothing, but I went to a state school. So for state school levels, I guess I was above the average. So did extra GCSEs. And I was part of like debate teams. I played a lot of sport. And then after school, I went to university, studied mathematics, graduated at 21, and just really wanted to do a gap year. Always just loved traveling. I grew up with a dad that worked for British Airways. So He took early retirement due to ill health, but when he retired, he still got the comps for British Airways. And it meant that after he retired, or took early retirement, we got to travel so much as a family. So I had like loads of family holidays in South Africa and going to India and America and places in Europe and South Africa, which was my favorite family holiday when I was 10 years old. So I was really lucky and I was really blessed. My parents didn't really... they weren't into materialistic things even now, and they didn't spend money on going out and dinners and buying us like lavish gifts, but we got to see the world. You know, my dad would say that, let me show you the world, you can see the UK on your own. So I went to university, graduated at 21, took a gap year, went traveling to 15 countries, which was self-funded. I'd had like 5 streams of income at university. I know, I think more than what I have now, to be honest. I was just always doing stuff. I was so adamant of filling my time with stuff. I did this army thing, which I got paid for. I was tutoring maths for £20 an hour, working in the student like union library, and then having bar jobs and working at Royal Ascot and stuff like that. So just had loads of like money coming in. So I graduated at 21 with 10 grand saved up. What had happened, my parents, I'd bought a car when I was 20, but my parents had said, you're paying for half and then we'll pay for half. And but on my 21st birthday, they gave the money back to me that I had paid half for. So my parents always did that. Like even growing up, I remember, you can buy any present you want with your Christmas money, but we'll pay for half. So I've always had to, like, I remember this, like buying something and then looking in the Argos catalogue, but I had to pay for half. So then it really means that you value your money, you know? So I had these like values installed into me from my parents. And then, so I graduated, went on this gap year, went to 15 countries in 2010, climbed Kilimanjaro, did this 3 months in Central America. And then I moved to Spain to learn Spanish.
That's absolutely amazing. And what that story tells me is that you've been molded into a very independent woman from early on, and your parents and grandparents have molded you into that person. Take me back to a time where you've sort of had to be strong for yourself within that period.
Within that period that I've just explained? I think one of my failures that from that period was I got a 2.2 in my mathematics degree, and I'd always been a higher achiever, and I struggled with maths at degree level. I was flying through it at GCSE A levels. I did all these maths awards that were set by, I think, Warwick or Leeds University. So I was like a mathlete. I would get in the top 2% of the country. I had like a bronze, a gold, and a silver. And I just really struggled at degree level maths. And it felt like it was regurgitating it. I was just regurgitating proofs and just like some of the stuff that we taught. It's not like I was, you know, using algebra or way to find X, and I love that. So I got a 2.2 in my mathematics degree, and it meant that the internship that I did with Deloitte, I'd got a graduate job offer lined up with them. And at that time, the Big Four had a minimum criteria of a 2.1 or above. Years later, like 4 to 6 years later, they changed the rules. But at the time when I graduated in 2009, it just meant, yeah, that they weren't having it and they weren't taking me on. And that's when I kind of did, that was really like quite upsetting, because at every point in my life there'd always been a plan, like, okay, you do school, you do A levels, you do university. And whilst I was at university, I'd put the things in place, done the internship, got the graduate job lined up, and that's the thing that I was going to do for at least the next 3 years, because you have to qualify as an accountant or with the tax exams that they give you that you do. And then it was kind of like I felt really lost, that, okay, now what do I do? I can't apply for this job. I can't do that. I remember applying to loads of jobs with not the Big Four, but then the next set of accountancy firms, and just getting rejected and rejected because they wanted a 2.1. And so I ended up getting a job, which was paying 20 grand a year. So it was a bit of a hit from the 28 that I would have been starting on. And Deloitte also offered you a £7,000 interest-free loan, and you could go traveling and you could take a sabbatical. And I was so adamant I wanted to do this. Just had this traveling bug because of what my parents, you know, taking me on holidays. And so really wanted to travel and didn't end up getting Deloitte, but, and so couldn't take that loan. But I had 10 grand saved up by the time I'd graduated from uni. So I just decided to do it on my own. The job that I was doing, I did that for 3-4 months. And then in January 2010, I went on my, like, I guess, world tour. I came back for little bits and bobs. I had such a brilliant time. Met friends that I'm still in touch with. Lived with a Spanish family who are still a big part of my life.
Whereabouts did you go? Spain?
I went to Seville for 2 months because I got onto I don't think they do it anymore, but the EU was doing these Leonardo da Vinci internships where they fully fund you for 10 weeks to live and have a language course, and then you have like a work experience. So I chose Seville. I really wanted Spain because I was obsessed with wanting to learn Spanish, and they did it the other way, like Spanish, Italians and Europeans could come to the UK. So I did that, lived in Seville for 2 months because it was only like 10 weeks, had a bunch of friends come visit me, and then I found like a language assistant role. Basically, I was a glorified au pair, but I was living with a Spanish family because my Dutch friend who had lived with a French family had said, Davinda, you'll really learn Spanish when you live with a family. You'll be forced to. They won't speak your language, and so you're going to have to speak theirs. So I got paired up with this Spanish family in the north, in a tiny little city called Tudela. I thought I was going to Toledo. And Toledo was like just outside of Madrid. And I was like, oh, great. I'm going to this like medieval city. Went to the north and I'm like, this is really cold. This isn't Spain. I've gone from the south all the way to the north. But honestly, I had the most brilliant time. The Spanish family that I lived with, they're a big part of my life now. I've got my Spanish brother and Spanish sister that are 10, 11 years younger than me. And yeah, I love hanging out with them. And yeah.
So what happened next after that?
So I went to New York. So I got onto a graduate program to go to New York for a year. And I then worked for two investment banks there. And so kind of had to like kind of do a little bit of a 90 degree angle, I say, from like, I wouldn't say 180 because it was still moving, but just not, you know, forward in the direction that I thought it was going to be. So went to New York, and from the work experience of working at two investment banks, when I came back to London, I had like a 6-month role, a contracting at I can't even remember what it is now, like a management company. And then I got the job at HSBC, which is where I stayed for like nearly 5 years, and then was a trader with them. But it was off the back of my work experience in New York, working at two investment banks.
So you've gone full circle really now, haven't you?
And it's so funny. I felt like a real failure when I had that Deloitte job taken away from me. But in those 3 years, I had so much more life experience. I learned another language, which I still speak now. I can switch it on and off, like speaking Spanish. And I learned another language. I ended up being adopted into a Spanish family. Yeah. You know, my Spanish mum has come to India with me and my grandparents and has come to my family weddings and has come and stayed in London. And so they're a really big part of my life. And yeah, I just got more valuable experiences. And then the job that the salary that I started on at HSBC was higher than the salary I would have started on post graduating with the tax, like qualifications that you get. So I was like, huh, I lucked out. This actually ended up, you know, being a little bit better.
And again, I think that's amazing that you've gone full circle and you ended up creating your own success. What would you say has been your biggest struggle to date?
To date, probably like the own demons that you have in your head or that have, say, like hindered me within business or in relationships.
What do you mean by that?
So I guess I only recently have discovered therapy in the past 2.5 years. And the more that I become like self-aware and I guess compassionate and kind and listening and really listening to people, I think I could have done with these skills 10 years ago. And like actually listening to people and hearing their pain and, you know, like just forming those deep relationships. And so I guess my biggest struggle has been the feelings around self-worth and the bouts of depression I've had when I was 16 and then later when I was like 32.
What happened 10 years ago?
Nothing that happened per se 10 years ago, but I wish I'd had the awareness I have now 10 years ago. So if this is the journey that I'm on, in 10 years' time, whichever space I'm in, would I have been there earlier if I had discovered, you know, how to, yeah, manage my emotions, not get triggered, be kinder and nicer and create space and let people listen rather than being a bit of a Rottweiler.
You spoke about depression. Have you ever been through that?
Yes. So I feel like I'm going to start welling up.
Fine, take your time.
I was depressed when I was 16, and at the time I just didn't have the tools to deal with what was going on. And although now when I think about it, there wasn't that much going on, but as a child it still was quite devastating. And yeah, like I tried to take my own life. In the kitchen there's always like pills or they used to be, and I just went and like consumed 40, 50 pills. I didn't even know what they were. I was so sick, like I was just throwing up. My body obviously didn't react to it very well. And I'd got a knife, and like even now as I say this, it's so not in line with me as a person, but I got a knife and I just felt like there was all this pain inside me and I just wanted it to go. And I didn't want to kill myself, but I just wanted to like have the pain go out. So I remember getting a knife and just cutting my leg, and I remember lying in bed and it just felt like the pain was coming out from that little hole. You know when you have like there's a bottle of water and there's like a little hole in it and it just starts dripping out, and that's what it felt like, that the pain was just dripping out because I could feel the pain from the cut. And it was just like super soothing. I've never cut myself before or after that, but that little cut was just like what I needed just to feel like the pain was like leaving my body. So yeah, that was the worst thing.
Where did the pain come from?
I would say it's like external things. Growing up culturally, there's a certain like set of ideals that you follow. And I guess I was like brainwashed into thinking that that was the way. Like, yeah, my brother had a kid, illegitimate, I guess, and I was 20 and I didn't tell anyone for a year. And until my cousins and my best friends came to my 21st birthday, and I took my best friends up into my bedroom and I said, oh, guys, like my brother's coming over with his son. and he's 1 year old, but my cousins and aunts and uncles are going to be meeting him for the first time, so don't hog him, okay? And they just looked at each other like, did you know? But if I was, and I was saying this to my cousins on the weekend, but if I was 30 and my brother had a kid the way he had, I would have obviously been talking and praising about it. But I was, culturally, I thought that I was brainwashed to think that this was the way, you know, you can't talk about it because your brother's done this, and it's a representation of me. But it's not, and I now know it's not. But when I was young and I had Punjabi Indian university friends come over to the family home, they'd go, oh wow, you're really Indian, like, considering what your brother's done, I didn't think that you were. They just thought we were like a really modern liberal family, you know. And I'm like, no, my grandparents live here, I speak Punjabi with them, I don't speak English. And so I had these like traditional values, and it came with a set way that you have to live, but it's not. And I think this is the exploring with therapy, because it's allowed me to be self-aware and go, yeah, my brother's done this, but you know what, we've got an amazing, like, I've got an amazing niece and nephew who are my world in my life. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, he did that because of whatever journey he was going through. But in so many cultures, that's not seen as a negative. You know, why was it in my family and I was brainwashed that I needed to hide my nephew for a year?
Have you spoken to your brother since?
We don't have the best relationship, but I've never spoken to him deeply about any of these things. We have a very toxic relationship, but his kids are my world, and I think I'm their world from what they say. And also my sister-in-law, so his wife, is my best friend. So I maintain a relationship with everyone around him apart from him.
And see, you've discovered therapy.
Mm.
How is that helping you now?
Yeah, like, it allows me to look at things objectively. And I think that's really important. So when I'm triggered or I'm upset and I think, okay, what would you say to a friend? You know, like, okay, this has happened, but why? And also just being empathetic and trying to think, why did this person do this? Why? And I had a brilliant friend stay with me. He was in the UK for 9 months, and he was a very big advocate on men's mental health. And we'd talk about stuff, and he would just say to me, well, why do you think that person did that? Why do you think your brother's done that? Why do you think your nephew's done that? Or I'm just giving examples because we've talked to my brother and nephew. And I go, well, I'm not sure. And then I explore it, and I'm like, maybe because they feel really hurt. Maybe they feel, you know, and that's how they lash out, because they don't have the tool. And it's just allowed me to feel more compassionate and empathetic towards people, and also to be objective.
I agree. And I think there's a huge difference between people showing sympathy rather than empathy.
Mm.
Because when you show sympathy, it can quite often relate to the other person getting annoyed.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
So another guest that came onto the podcast, who I'm not going to name, and including myself, who's got health conditions. So when you show sympathy to someone, let's say, use me as an example, when epilepsy, oh, you've got this wrong with you. Yeah, I know, but it's not going to impact the way that I live. I'm not going to rule my life. And again, depression, being another example. I've been through that. People know that I've been through. I went to rehab or bin section, whatever the case may be. Oh my God, that must have been so bad. It's a situation I've been through, you know the story. Don't show sympathy, empathize.
Yes.
There's a huge difference between, oh, I feel so sorry for you. You don't need to feel sorry. There's a huge difference between the two.
That's really interesting you just said that, because I think I used to give a lot of sympathy and I used to say the exact same sentence that you've said. And now I listen, I go, wow, you're so inspiring. And I've changed my wording without even realizing it's only when you've said that. Because I don't think I ever say, I feel sorry for you. I'm like, wow, that's really inspiring. You've like picked yourself up. And when we've had personal conversations and when you told me your story, I was like, wow, you've gone through so much. That's so amazing that you've picked yourself up and look what you've done, you know? And I would say that's really inspiring.
And don't get me wrong, there's people talk about it, and which is good. But a lot of the people will need a pat on the back. A lot of people need to vent off. A lot of people will need that ear to chew off. And it's good. You need that. However, when people show, and this is just me, I might be wrong, but when people show me sympathy, it goes completely over my head now, because I've developed tools, as you've said, not to get annoyed, because I used to get annoyed about it. I don't know how you feel about that. I mean,
I don't really get sympathy.
No, well, I mean, again, that's only my perception of it. I mean, people listening, they might have, it might be something to look at.
Yeah.
It might be to go, if people are showing you sympathy, is that the right thing to receive?
Mm.
You may want to look at, again, going starting therapy.
Mm.
But I mean, obviously that's how you cope with the depression through that stage of your life. And I'm right in saying it was around 16, when you was about 16.
Yeah, so I didn't do therapy then, but I told school and had a counsellor assigned to me.
Okay.
Because I was exceptionally bright, gifted and talented, and winning all these maths awards in the debate team, and I played a lot of sport, and I was on every sports team. I loved netball, played football, and ran. And so I'd get picked for the other sports team that I wasn't very good at. And so I was kind of like this, just, you know, I was quite active in school. And teachers could see that. And I was quite, I remember when I met Black Leanne and White Stacey, they completely changed my personality in year seven. But I became a little bit cocky and a little bit of a gobshite. I would talk back, but I found my confidence. And it's so funny because it was only recently talking through it with a therapist that I was like, I did that because I didn't feel like I was heard at home. And I had an older brother, which I felt at the time, I don't feel it now, that got everything.
Mm.
You know, he's a boy, omundaya, okar sakta, you can't, he can do it, you can't. And so I didn't have a voice at home. Mm. So then I was like loud and brash at school. Mm. And all eyes were on me, you know, and I my personality completely changed because of Stacey and Leanne. And it was brilliant. There were these like really like loud, confident girls. And then I would be this loud, confident Indian girl. So I got moved a year from one side of the year to the other year. But like, I think the teachers could see. And then I opened up to one teacher and then they had a counselor assigned and that what I did. And yeah, so I didn't have like full therapy then. I didn't even know what it was. If you're not exposed to it, you just don't know, right?
Of course.
And I think, it's so crazy. I would come home from school and I would sleep from say like 5 till the next morning. And even now it's my coping mechanism. But I don't know. I think like when you have GCSEs or you have things to look forward to. I remember it's so funny, like my best friends, even now, I started drifting from them and I would hang out with another group, you know, and it's so crazy because they were my best friends at school. And even now they're the ones that are part of my life. But yeah, there was like loads of little things going on and I was just too young to deal with it at the time. And I'm sure now it'd be nothing, you know. But yeah, just when I was 16, there was a lot going on.
How about building relationships? Because it's not that I struggle to build relationships. I struggle to keep good relationships going with, or the intimacy within the relationship, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, or one, it becomes too intense.
Okay.
And then, or whatever I'm doing, let's say, again, property, because we're both involved in that.
Yeah.
I will work at 100 miles an hour and it will drive the other person away.
Mm, okay.
Or business. We'll use that as an example because, you know, I've got one of my own.
Yeah.
Because I'm going 100 miles an hour, there's a lot of stuff going on in your head. You don't like other distractions going on.
Mm-hmm.
So how have you found building relationships?
Yeah, on a personal level,
yeah,
I find it really easy to build relationships. I feel I connect with, I try to always find something to connect with someone. Mm. And there's a certain type of people that I vibe with. And that's quite evident because, yeah, I think all of my friends are quite similar in a similar way. And you were my birthday brunch on the weekend.
Yeah.
So there's a certain type that I vibe with, but I do like, you know, to connect with people. So personally, I find it really easy to build relationships and maintain them. I've still got friends from, for 30 years, from primary school, secondary school, university, the army thing that I did when I was at university, from my working days, from living in Spain. But in a business sense, yeah, I have found it that the 100 miles per hour thing, because a little bit like you, I've been going at 100 miles per hour and you meet people and you're like, oh, they're just draining me. They're just holding me back. And so you find to vibe with the certain people that are running at 100 miles per hour. But when you're working in the same business, I think it is really difficult. So if you have a business partner, and that I don't have a business partner, I've always been a one-man band, and maybe to my detriment as well. So I've never collaborated, but it is something now that I think I want to do. But knowing somebody that's got, say, the opposite skill set to me, that we then won't clash. And I think if I was trying to get a business partner or somebody within my business to do what I do, that's where it would probably fail, because I need somebody to be even more brilliant than me at something that I can't do. And so I think that's the thing and the key that I've discovered. Yeah, I think a little bit, when it's like your baby, it's a little bit like control. You want to keep that control as well. And so there's certain things that I want to drive, but I'm happy certain things not to be driven by me.
And you say on personal relationships, and what you say, you've got a good personal relationship, you're good at building personal relationships, certainly with friends. That's certainly something that I can get people in a room, but keeping a relationship, again, I've been married, divorced. That's something that obviously you don't want it to happen, but has happened. How have you felt, obviously, growing up, keeping a relationship going?
You mean like with a romantic partner?
Yeah, romantic partner, yeah.
Yeah, so, I've been engaged and was supposed to get married. But that, again, if I discover therapy earlier, I feel I would have had the tools in place, because there were times where I didn't create space and listen. And now that I've learned to really listen, when someone's telling you something, like, you should listen to them. And nobody, like what you said, like, you've been married and divorced. Nobody gets married to get divorced, right? You don't
think.
You get married for the long term because you believe and you connect with this person. And unfortunately, things do happen, or you grow apart, or you lose that connection. And there were points in my relationship where I lost the connection, but it like dipped as a roller coaster. We got it back, and then we lost it a little bit, and we got it back, and we lost it. And there was a lot of like separation and getting back together. But you deeply love this person. And I think there's a difference between love and relationships. You can completely be in love with someone and then know that you can't be in a relationship with them, because for whatever, there's like anxiety or sadness. And as much as this person was the most brilliant and amazing person in my life, and who probably, I'll probably never be loved the way he's loved me, we can't be in a relationship together.
Why?
Because there was a lot of sadness there, day to day. And I don't think I could get over that sadness.
What happened?
So we had a difference in upbringing and his lived experience, which is completely valid. And I wasn't empathetic and I wasn't kind to his situation. So he wasn't wrong for, you know, his habits and what he went through, but I wasn't wrong either. So even now, I'm 35 and all four of my grandparents are alive right now. I met 4 out of 8 of my great grandparents, and I've come from a Punjabi Indian family where it's pretty much vegetarian meals. You know, we do eat meat, but it's pretty much like just chicken, and there might be some turkey slices, you know, once in a while, or turkey at Christmas. But yeah, some sausages and pigs in blankets, but it's mainly like vegetarian. And drinking is taboo, especially for women. Now I think, you know, there's my generation that are breaking those barriers and breaking that culture. But that's what I grew up with. And he grew up in a restaurant family where accessibility to red meat and eating restaurant food and drinking alcohol was just on tap. And unfortunately, due to lifestyle and maybe habits, his parents both passed away at 53, but 9 years apart. But he wasn't wrong either for his experience, but neither was I. So day to day, daily, it was those triggers that would really upset me, like the relationship with food, the relationship with alcohol, the accessibility to it, which I hadn't really grown up with, because I didn't grow up with parents that took us to restaurants. We always ate at home. My mum and grandma were brilliant at cooking these like fantastic meals, and even still, you know, love mum's cooking. And ordering food was just not a thing. Even now, like I personally, I do not even order food because I cook. And also I have a car, so I can do a big food shop. And when we lived together, it was the accessibility of like ordering food that wasn't necessarily in line with like the lifestyle that I wanted to live, or the healthy habits that I want to have and want, say, our kids or my kids to have. And so there was a real clash of that. And it starts small, but it becomes every day. And, you know, but he wasn't wrong. And that's his lived experience.
And I can 100% resonate with what you're saying, because I'm going through something very similar myself right now. And in fact, I want to ask you this. What have you developed, the tools you've developed now, going through therapy?
Yeah.
What would you do differently now at the beginning of your relationship?
I think I would have listened and I would have been kinder and I would have been nicer in my approach with how I spoke about things. Mm. And when I would get triggered, that's when the unkindness comes out. You shout, you nag, you know, constantly say, make those little digs and make those comments. And I know I have this superpower, because one of my superpowers is being able to convince people to do what I want, right? I talk about this with everyone. I'm like, everyone has a superpower. Naval talks about this as you like specified knowledge. You have a skill that is so authentic to you that if somebody spent 1,000 hours, 10 years trying to perfect the skill that you have, they will not come close. So you learn, you try to tap into your childhood, speak to your parents, people that knew you, what were you brilliant at as a kid that you shined about, and just tap into that. So, and I know I have this, but when I was triggered, I wasn't able to be nice and kind. And even later, I got told that the comment that got said was, everything Davinder said was right. It was just in the way that she said it.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is, like, then when, like, you are doing therapy and you're talking about your childhood and the way that your parents have parented, my parents could have said the exact same thing to me, but just kinder. Mm. You know, my mom didn't need to criticize or be judgmental. I would have done the same. I would have listened then, you know. And so that's what I take on board. So, you know, I don't have my own kids yet, and I have a niece and nephew. And so I'll listen to them. And I'll go, well, you know, what about changing this behavior? Why do you think that? And I didn't have those tools. I think before I would have gone, no, you need to do this, you need to do that, because that's how I'd been parented and educated. And that's what I was taking into my relationship.
So moving nicely on to talking about children, you've recently undergone an operation.
Mm.
So I'll let you explain.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited to talk about this. So I had my eggs frozen, and I'd been actually in my relationship with the Spanish guy. He was like quite liberal, and he was like, yeah, I think it's great. Because I was 3 years older than him. Although you couldn't tell, because he was way more mature. And he would say, people would ask him, do you notice the age difference? And he would just go, no, I'm way more mature than her. But I'm like the fun one, as you could see, you know, yeah, on the weekend. I'm like trying to dance and always just like getting a little boogie in. And so He had said, yeah, I think it's great. Like, because we'd be fine for the first two, but we might struggle for the third. And I'd go, oh, there's a third. So I'd go, okay. And when you have a partner that's supportive and saying those things, you become more open to it. So even when we were together, I listened to a podcast. I got my fertility checked. I went to a fertility clinic. And everything was in the normal ranges. And but just on the low side, so within the normal grasp, but just on the low side, nothing that I felt I needed to be worried about. So I had that in my head. And then when you have a breakdown in relationship, so I actually then ended up in like a 7-month relationship after. And again, it was something that I talked about with this person, just because you don't want to jump into something new with someone, right? Like it took me 4 years to realize like I wasn't going to marry this person. And maybe if I follow that pattern, maybe that might happen with this new person. But you just don't want to jump into things because you think that your biological clock is ticking, you know. And so I didn't want to do things from a place of insecurity. And I do know people that have done that, where they've done things from a place of insecurity, and that's not how I want to live my life. So it just felt like doing this, and both of them were really supportive. The second guy was from Eastern Europe, so he was saying that, oh, well, it's much cheaper. Why don't we do it there and stay at a friend's flat? And, you know, it'd be much cheaper. So I froze my eggs, and I'm so glad I did it. And I've been talking about it. I've told all my family and friends. I told my mum, I told my cousins. And then I'll go, if I don't have the relationship, you know, with that person, I go, why don't you tell that person that I'm doing it? Maybe it might inspire them. She's 3 years younger, you know, maybe she should. And so, but I didn't want to dictate. I think lead by example. And so, yeah, like, I think I've opened the door to a lot of my friends doing it. I wish people had been talking about it 5 years ago, because I would have done it then. And I think the reason why they weren't is because people weren't having kids or having fertility issues 5 years ago. And if they were, they weren't talking about it. And a few of my friends have had kids now, and they've had kids, or they know stories about people that have been through 8, 6, 11 rounds of IVF. So in my head, it was like, okay, how do I learn from their lived experience? You know, so, okay, how do I never go through IVF in my life? Well, if you freeze your eggs, that's one route. And then when you're on this fertility journey, you realize that the best quality, or the most fertile you have, the best quality follicles or eggs, is when you're 22 to 24. And obviously, I know people that have naturally got pregnant at 44. But if it's 22 to 24 and they're the better quality ones because they decline by age, then I'm like, oh, wow, I wish I'd done this at 22. But I didn't know. Mm. You know, nobody was talking about it. It's awareness. You don't know what you don't know. And so now, I think if I have a daughter, that's something I would advise. You know, I'd advise her and encourage her to do it so that she can. And now you can freeze your eggs for up to 55 years. And they changed the rules last year. It was only 10 years. But yeah, I have a really brilliant support network. I have a lot of friends that are my age and older that, you know, aren't married and aren't having kids, aren't sexually active, and don't have boyfriends. And for me, coming out of 5 years worth of relationships, I was like, this is the thing that I feel like I want to do. And you know, I don't know what the stats are, but there'll be loads of us that will have fertility issues. So it was just trying to like avoid that, you know, because as we age, and yeah. And so I was just trying to avoid that, to be honest.
I think what you just touched on, having a support network of people around you, I would imagine that helped a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Everyone's been so kind. No one's been judgmental. Everyone's been really nice about it. And yeah.
Where can people find out more information about this? Obviously yourself. But if you Google it, like anything,
yeah,
become a doctor for yourself, it's the wrong thing to
yes,
do.
Yes, stay away from the internet.
Where can people find out more information about, or the best, in your opinion, place to find out more information?
Yeah, so I listened to this podcast and that was really helpful in 2020. Was it 2020? No, it would have been later. Yeah, no, 2, 3 years ago. That was really helpful because it was a woman sharing her journey. So I watched YouTube videos, and I remember watching a YouTube video, and this woman said, it was an American woman, and she went, oh, just get your fertility checked yearly. And it was little things. I went to TEDx Talks and James Sahota's event, and they had a property event, and they had like a fitness guy doing a presentation, and he said, just yearly, every 6 months, get your blood checked. Mm-hmm. You know, if you care about your health. And I'm like, obviously I care about my health. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, why was I not doing these things? And it's because people aren't talking about it.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think so many people around me are playing Russian roulette with their fertility, and also just delaying the process for whatever reason, but not putting the tools in place. So it's like, we're either all going to be doing IVF, or we're all going to be freezing our eggs so that, you know, we don't have to do the 6, 8, 11 rounds of IVF. So yeah, I think it's people sharing their fertility stories with me and being like, how do I learn from this? One of my best friends went to her cousin's wedding, who was 46 when she got married. And maybe I'll be 46 when I get married and find love. And that's totally okay. So, and it was her saying to me, Devinda, just freeze your eggs. And I thought, you know what, if she was 46, she was 34, you know, would she have done this? Of course. Because I'm now thinking, I should have done it at 32, at 22, sorry.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I hate living my life with regrets. And that was one of the things, what would I regret more? And it's not that expensive. I also had this like idea that it was like 15 grand, but it's 3.5. It's less than I paid for my Invisalign. It's less than what laser eye surgery would be. It's less than money that I've spent on like hair removal of laser and electrolysis and waxing over the past 5 years. Do you know? And those are temporary fixes. So yeah, when in perspective, when you put it in that perspective, like I just thought this, I don't want to regret, you know, it. So that's something that I want to do. And the other thing is, when you read a book and someone's written a book, they share their, they use all the knowledge and the experience that they've had, and they put it into this book to share it with you. That's so much wisdom. Mm-hmm. And we can learn so much from the world's renowned therapists, doctors, medics, and, you know, musicians, mathematicians, and whatever you follow, and fitness experts. And so it was more like, well, let me learn from someone else's lived experience so that I can make better choices. I don't need to be 46 and doing 11 rounds of IVF. I can be 34 and freezing my eggs. Does that make sense?
That's powerful. If anyone's listening that's thinking about doing it, reach out to Davinder.
Yeah, for sure.
Obviously, the Instagram handles, all of your platforms are going to be putting in, I'll put them in the description. I want to talk about your property journey. And actually, no, you're going to talk about your property journey. But I want to ask, where did Spot the Dave come from?
So it was a joke that started when I went to Brazil in 2015. We went for a carnival. And my friend Sonia, so I speak Spanish, and although in Brazil they speak Portuguese, I was talking Spanish with the Brazilians, and they'd call me La Española. But they could understand my Spanish and I could understand their Brazilian, and it was better than speaking in English or Punjabi, which is the other language I speak, right? So it was like, okay, default factory mode settings, which one do I go into in my brain, right? Spanish. And so my friend was like, it's like Spot the Dog. It's like Spot the Dave. Like, where are you? Just keep running around. And it's carnival. You're having street parties. You know, you're with your friends, but you might lose them. You're like 10 meters away from them. You can't see them. And so she was like, it's Spot the Dave. And I remember taking a photo on the beach and putting hashtag Spot the Dave on there. And this is, Instagram wasn't that big in my life in 2015. And so I've still got that photo and I love it. I changed my handle like 2 years after that in 2017. And I remember conceptualizing what I wanted Spot the Dave to be. And it wanted to be, and I found my notes on my phone about it recently in 2017. I wanted it to be about travel and like empowerment and business, I guess, because I was going to do property, but was just finding my feet in it. And that was it. It just became a thing. And my nickname's Dave, because Punjabi names are unisex. And usually when a man is named Davinder, his nickname's been Dave. So, and a friend started calling me Dave when I was like 14. And then it just turned into a thing.
So what's next for you?
Yeah, more property projects. I want to do collaborative stuff this year rather than thinking individualistically, which is what I've done before. And seeing how I can utilize my experience and knowledge in a way where I pair up with somebody that maybe has the opposite skills to me. Okay. So we're not stepping on each other's toes. Yeah. So when I'm running at 100 miles per hour, it's okay because they can run at 100 miles per hour in their lane and what they're doing. I want to do more collaborative things within property. It's the thing that I know the most, that I've enjoyed the most. And although I have this love-hate relationship with builders, and I never want to do a refurb ever again because his latest project is driving me up the wall, I still have that like drive and passion for it, you know, that creation of something. And it's the thing that I know the most.
I can't wait to get Tejon because I know it's just going to go in on builders.
Yeah.
What did you want to get out of the podcast today?
I wanted to talk about my egg freezing journey. I remember we talked about it. And I said, I'm going to share it. I put a little video up recently because it was only a few days ago, and it's just raising awareness. And I do wish, you know, people were talking about it 5, 6, 7 years ago, because then it would have been the seeds that I would have done earlier. But it is what it is. You know, I discovered it when I did. And I think like the accessibility, and the more people open up and talk about these things, I think it becomes, it's not so foreign, you know. And when I've shared my journey, so I've had so many stories of people's fertility issues. So definitely wanted to raise awareness of that. Just make people feel comfortable. Because I think there's a bit of a stigma and there's a bit of a taboo attached to it. Mm. It doesn't have to be painful.
You mentioned empowerment before. Mm. And I think you've empowered a lot of people, and you certainly will. And you've empowered me, I know you've empowered a lot of people. And again, you brought a room full of people together. And they weren't just all in property. Mm. They were from university.
None of my friends.
Exactly. And it was such a good, lovely environment to be involved in. And I thank you for inviting me. it was such a good environment.
Yeah, it was really fun.
It was fantastic. I've got a couple more questions for you.
Cool.
So, in fact, I'll ask you this one now. If there was one final message, this is not, I haven't got this written down. So if you've got one final message for your brother, what would it be?
Final message. He's still alive.
I know he's alive.
I see him very frequently because I maintain a relationship with everyone in his immediate family.
So if you've got a final message for your brother, what would it be?
A final message. Just a message. Final sounds a little bit morbid, doesn't it? So a message to my brother. Just to be kind. He's so brilliant and he could get everything in the world if he was just kind and he learned how to manage his emotions. Mm. That's it. Just to be kind, nicer. I mean, the other thing that I talk about is therapy. I think everyone should do therapy. You know, I think it's so powerful to become self-aware. I've talked about it on social media and so many people have messaged me and been like, oh, I'm thinking about it. I'm like, do it. And you don't even have to go through grief or some serious pain to do it. I haven't. I feel like I've lived such a blessed and comfortable and easy life, but I still have triggers or things in my head. I have self-sabotaged in the past. You know, I've had an anxious attachment style and at times been an avoidant as well. So it's like, how do I navigate through that or always be working from a place of authenticity rather than being insecure or upset or doing things from insecurity? Do therapy. Everyone should do it.
I agree. And I know there's a stigma attached to therapy and all, there's a huge taboo around it, but I completely agree with you. Everyone should go through it, or they should just talk to people. Not just men, women as well. Yeah. And men, there is a stigma attached to it, but I think it's a load of shit. People should talk. But I always wrap these podcasts up with the same question. And it's very simple. And it's, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. Yeah, I'm in a really good place. We celebrated my birthday on the weekend and it was so lovely just to have a room full of people that I love and they love me. And I'm so lucky. I'm so blessed with the people that are in my life and all my friends that you met that are my friends that are outside and property people are now my friends as well. I do count, a lot of them as my friends. None of them are in property. None of them are doing it. And I love them for that. You know, I wasn't in property until a few years ago. So they're not going to stop being my friends just because that's not the thing we talk or vibe about. We talk and vibe about so many different things. And yeah, I'm in a really good place.
Good.
Yeah.
And we're going to wrap this up now, but obviously I've not even known you long.
Mm-hmm.
And again, sympathy and empathy is huge for me. But to listen to where you've come from, to where you are now, it's a huge achievement. You should be so proud of yourself.
Thank you.
And anyone listening, they need to reach out to you, especially for, obviously, the fertility.
Yeah, I'm happy to share it.
Yeah.
And even I posted a little video on my social media. I didn't talk about what it was because I wanted this to be the first release of it. But when people messaged me and said, oh, good luck, I was like, oh, thanks. You know, just got my eggs frozen. So people individually, personally knew.
Yeah.
And I talked about it personally to people and friends. And yeah, I had some really supportive friends. A friend came with me. I stayed at hers for 2 nights. And yeah, it wasn't a crazy experience. I thought it was going to be super easy, super chilled. I think also I was mentally prepared for it. And sometimes that can take a while. And a few years, but I felt really invigorated and liberated doing it. So,
good. I think you're a true inspiration. Keep being you.
Thank you.
And keep being Dave.